This is The Hindu on Books, a weekly podcast from India's national newspaper on the latest and the best from the world of literature.
Hello and welcome to The Hindu on Books podcast. I'm Anand Krishnan, your host for today. In this episode, we are joined by Rukmini S., data journalist and author of Whole Numbers and Half Truths, What Data Can and Cannot Tell Us About Modern India, a fascinating book that draws upon a range of numbers to answer some of the burning political, social, and economic questions that India is dealing with. Everything from crime in India to what Indian people think, feel, and believe, how India votes, and even the healthcare sector in India and how we dealt with the COVID-19 pandemic. In the course of this book, Rukmini draws on-the-ground reporting as well as data and questions some of the most deeply held conventional wisdoms about Indian politics, economy, health, and society. Rukmini, thank you so much for joining the Hindu on Books podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Anand.
To begin with, Rukmini, can you just tell us a little bit about how this book came about? I'm sure many of our listeners know that for many years you've been working as a data journalist, and also a little bit about how you got into data journalism in the first place.
Sure. So the book actually is a sort of combination of two strands of reporting that I've been doing over time. And these shouldn't necessarily be separate, but they were, and maybe they won't be in the future, which is I was first a sort of what you call a regular field reporter whose job, especially as an intern or a beginning career journalist, was to be sent all over the city or all over the country. And those sorts of experiences, I think, even though I may not have known it at the time, what they were doing was introducing me to the way democracy actually functions, the sort of nuts and bolts and levers of how India really operates. And what this meant is that when I transitioned to focusing more on data, which is something that came about as a result of me doing a sort of in-between master's degree, at which point I was exposed to research and statistics around India for the first time. I had not really paid any attention or learned about this before, and I wanted to start integrating this into the reporting I was doing. So what this ended up doing was that those years of experience on the field helped me understand the stories behind what I was seeing in research reports or in spreadsheets. And the fact that I was seeing these connections, some of them were to broaden or deepen my understanding of what the numbers said. Some of my experiences contradicted what the numbers said or sort of showed the gaps or holes or what was missing in it. So these sorts of intersections between quote-unquote real world and what numbers were showing me drove me to write a book about these sorts of connections and what they say about modern India.
What I really liked about it, Rukmini, about Whole Numbers and Half Truths, is it's not just chapter after chapter of you going into surveys and data, which you do, but in those chapters, you do bring about actual stories of people and individual stories that help put context to the numbers. So I think you make a sort of compelling case that it can't just be numbers don't tell you everything, but you kind of need a mix of having, for a journalist, you need a mix of having an on-the-ground sense of what's happening, what's behind those numbers. You kind of need both. Is that the broader point that you were trying to make?
Yeah, and I think you put it really well by putting it that way, because sometimes what journalists, especially data journalists, end up doing is something a bit more artificial and instrumental, which is to sort of very consciously try and humanize the numbers. This is, feedback that editors always give you. And then when you do that, you always get a sort of false note. You see that this one person is being used or one situation is being used as an archetype for what the numbers are saying. And over time, it becomes like a trope and quite tiresome to read. But if what you think you are doing is giving context or explaining how things play out in the real world or even complicating or contradicting what the numbers say, then I think it adds some richness to your work without feeling like a sort of manipulative ploy, which it can sometimes feel like, which is that you're telling readers that, hey, I know numbers alone are not going to draw you in. Here is my sort of manipulative way to get you in. So I think it's important to ensure, and I hope I've, you know, tried to do that, that I'm not doing it for these instrumental purposes, but because reality is messy and does sometimes show that the numbers are getting things wrong or are missing nuance or sort of, in fact, in, you know, more dangerous instances, giving you the wrong idea of what's actually happening.
Right. And so the book is divided into 10 chapters where you look at the courts and cops crime data and what it tells us about India. You have a chapter on values, which I found really fascinating. I'm sure the chapter that a lot of readers will find most interesting is how India votes, and things that you often read in the newspapers and listen to in the TV studios that kind of don't really explain the full picture. And it's not just about politics. There's a chapter on how people in India live, how they eat, their personal lives. And it's a really fantastic, there's so much I learned from it. And what I really liked about the book was it made me revisit so many conventional wisdoms that I read in the media, and I think you've done a great service by making us question those things. And I'm not going to go over all of it. That's something that I encourage people to discover themselves in the book. But I did want to begin with your chapter on health, because we are speaking on December 30th, when it's kind of this terrible deja vu feeling to what we experienced in late 2020. And in the book, now that we're dealing with a new variant, in the book you mention how maybe health more than anything else, if you get data wrong, the consequences can be devastating. It's life or death more than in any other sphere. So can you tell us a little bit about how has data and the way the government used data affected the way we responded to the pandemic?
Right, yes, and I think it's an important moment to be talking about it, because there's not just a deja vu in terms of, you know, another wave of the virus, but there's also a deja vu in terms of the conversations around Indian data that we're having, because so much has not progressed and we're having to have these conversations again, which is incredibly frustrating. So some of these, and I say this about multiple types of data in the book, which is that some of these issues are institutional and they've been, they're sort of legacy issues that have, you know, have their roots in earlier decades. And, you know, it points sometimes to, because India came into independence with a great deal of idealism around nation building, in which data was going to play a very important role. And the institutions that India built then were sort of the envy of the, not just the developing world, but the developed world as well. But there has been, you know, some amount of rot in those systems and a lot of lethargy over the last couple of decades as well. So when it comes to health data, I'd say the fact that India still does such a poor job of surveilling disease and infectious disease in particular is a legacy issue. This didn't, you know, crop up in the last couple of years. And for the continuing explanation to be that India is only able to get data from government systems is just something that should not fly any longer, given that we know that more people access health in the private sector than in the government sector now. So it's a huge failing that should have been remedied some time ago. And when you have such a small subset of people whose sort of health-seeking behavior you're able to capture, you're getting all sorts of things wrong. You're getting the extent to which the poor fall ill wrong. You're getting the extent to which women fall ill wrong, because, you know, they tend to be underrepresented in official data. The expenditure, particularly the sort of debilitating effect of out-of-pocket expenditure, we're just not, you know, getting a good enough sense of that. So those are some of the legacy issues we went into the pandemic with. And then, of course, there are all new issues that came up in the last 2-3 years. And again, I do want to emphasize that despite being a developing country, India has punched far below its weight when it comes to COVID data. So this isn't a lack of capacity issue alone. This is a country which could put up the sort of the best IT systems, or at least a website around whatever it chose to do overnight, but it's still not got an official repository of all COVID data. And this is still a volunteer-driven effort that's being done by people outside of government. So, you know, when I looked, I've been looking at Latin American countries right from the beginning of the pandemic, and it's appalling that Indian data hasn't got there yet. And, you know, other issues are a sort of combination of legacy and issues that are to do with the current moment, which is, for example, when it comes to registering deaths, India has had an immature registration system and has missed deaths. But then what you've added to it right now is a sort of refusal by the current administration to acknowledge accurate numbers, because it casts a shadow on what they would like to paint as a very successful handling of the pandemic. So these aren't sort of naive issues either. These are, they have a sharp edge, and that sharp edge is located in the politics of the moment.
And that was actually my next question, where you do mention that mortality data throughout the pandemic in India doesn't really give you a clear picture, and maybe it led to a false sense of confidence. And towards the end of 2020, there was a feeling that India was unique, people have natural immunity, all sorts of things were being said. But as you said, what's complicated this kind of, you do mention there are real problems, so many deaths are not registered. But then there is also the added issue of what you just hinted at, where the government has been saying, even in global fora, that India is a leader, India handled COVID well. So there's a very, very strong sort of political incentive to not have the full picture come out. So how much of that how much of it has been a genuine issue of not having the infrastructure to get a clear picture of what's happening, but how much of it is sort of a willful sense of ensuring things stay that way?
Yes, so I do think that it's a combination of the two, but I think by sort of beginning with this note of triumphalism from so early, the government has sort of painted itself into a corner, which is that mortality estimates by journalists and others, including me, for which we have used official Indian data on mortality from all causes during the pandemic and during past years to sort of estimate excess mortality, which is now a sort of globally accepted exercise. Those numbers do show a lot of missed deaths, but they would, in population adjusted terms, place India sort of where the rest of the world is, because, you know, mortality has been at a reasonably similar level in many countries. So it doesn't necessarily show that India had, you know, did the worst, especially proportionate to its population. But once you've decided, right, from as Modi in the World Economic Forum in 2021 at the beginning of this year announced that, you know, displayed this triumphalism, for example, once you've done that, you've sort of painted yourself into a corner where even accepting that the virus hit you as badly as it hit the rest of the world is an admission of defeat that you are no longer willing to make. So having reached that point, I think the government is now, you know, absolutely digging its heels in and refusing to accept these numbers. And what did happen in the pandemic is, one, there were these death registration systems that were not good enough, though they have improved significantly over the past. Then there was the issue of India adopting a very stringent definition of what constituted a COVID death, which in a country in which so many deaths in all times go undiagnosed, untreated, you know, unknown really, it was bound to miss a lot of deaths. And then to it, you add this sort of element of political triumphalism, which makes any sort of coming back to common ground almost impossible now.
Yeah, and the health chapter has more than COVID. I learned a lot about, I mean, it questions what you think about what is actually private healthcare in India, which is not just what you think of as big hospitals and big cities, but a much more complicated picture of how exactly healthcare works in India. Another theme that your book sort of emphasizes quite a bit in different chapters is the issue of caste. And it comes up in different ways. And you mentioned that there's sort of this perception among urban elite and liberals that caste no longer is an issue in India. Tell us a little bit about what you were kind of trying to respond to when you were making the argument about caste, and what surveys and numbers told you about that.
Right. So, yeah, I think caste in particular was one of those things that I felt that every time something came up in the news cycle, I was ending up writing a news article around it, which was basically saying, but this is what the data, when you look at it by caste, says. So I almost felt like I needed to sort of set this down in stone somewhere so that we're not having these same conversations again and again, at least in our small bubbles, and we can sort of move ahead after, you know, establishing some common, some basic understanding, which is that the centrality of caste to Indian life, which is something that people who bear the sharp edge of it bear witness to it every day, but those who don't can sort of see it in this casteless, colorless utopia. The centrality of caste is something we need to be talking about much more often. And this means looking at data, for example, on the continuing practice of untouchability, beginning from there and then talking about things like discrimination. You know, there is still a significant share of people who admit even in surveys to practicing untouchability. Then I think the thing that we need to talk about much more is just how rare and how unacceptable inter-caste marriage continues to be in India, that a majority of people, including young people, not just do not have inter-caste marriages, which we know are just 4 or 5% of all marriages, they also feel no one else should have it. They feel that it is something that it should oppose, that they should oppose. And just to put this in context, 85 years ago, Ambedkar said that, you know, the greatest solvent for caste would be inter-caste marriage. And the fact that we are still in a place where a majority of people feel that it's okay to even tell surveyors that they are opposed to inter-caste marriage says something about one big failure of India's democratic project for this to still be an acceptable response to surveyors, let alone what people think. Then there's also the data that intersects with class, which I don't think gets talked about often enough and needs to get talked about more, especially in the context of these sort of pretty pointless conversations around affirmative action and whether we need it or not, that sort of thing. When the data shows quite conclusively that across job categories, the forward castes make significantly more money than people from all other castes. Forward castes are highly overrepresented in all sorts of white collar occupations, and even at the same type of job, a forward caste person is likely to get paid much more than a person from any backward caste or a minority group. So when we have these conversations around the poor within forward caste, which we did, and that led to affirmative action for the poor among forward caste, it was a conversation devoid of data, because the data shows that this sort of sense of victimhood that is being sharpened in some ends is not in fact based in data at all. And then we have pretty strong sort of survey and experimental information around the practice of discrimination, whether it is in the job market or in the housing market or in the marriage market, where we know that there is a clear price to be paid for having either a Muslim or a backward caste last name. And this is, of course, the lived reality of the majority of the country, but it's just something that the data shows that forward caste people should be thinking more about.
And the caste issue is something that you also mentioned in your chapter on how India votes. And that's a chapter that I'm sure many listeners will find particularly interesting, given that you would think, given the amount of coverage we have on elections, that you would think by now we would have a handle of making sense of things. But yet you make the argument quite persuasively that oftentimes our readings of how people vote in elections aren't often borne out in the numbers. And something that always strikes me when I watch television election coverage is up until the result, people have no idea what exactly is going to happen. But yet, miraculously, when the results come out, people have great explanations of why people voted the way they did.
It's not just that if the outcome goes the opposite way, that same explanation can be repurposed for the exact opposite outcome. We have actually seen that happen on television. So these are very flexible theories as well.
Can you tell us a little bit? I mean, there's a lot in the chapter on elections, but just to give us a flavor of it, what were some of the things that really struck you that don't perhaps get as much attention as they should?
So I think one of the things that's happened in the last 5 or 10 years is the pushing of a narrative that the Indian voter values, economic growth and jobs and the sort of amorphous concept of development so much that what is seen as past, loyalties around religion or caste have ceased to matter. This is a narrative beloved of the Indian media and also peddled by some political parties, particularly the BJP at the time of national elections in particular. And I think what's happened is a sort of something of a groupthink situation where even people creating, conducting, and then analyzing surveys have sort of limited their imagination around questions and then take this very literal interpretation of survey responses. So surveys, and in fact surveys dating back from the 50s and 60s, regularly show that the Indian voter says that they are voting for like the top 1, 2, 3 issues would usually be jobs and economic growth, better development, that sort of thing. And these answers have been taken to very literally mean that this is what matters most to voters. But then the same voter also says that 45% of voters say, for example, that they would want an MP who belongs to their own caste. We also do see that a Muslim MP now in India can only get elected from a Muslim majority constituency. So this sort of literal interpretation of surveys, I think, has done a great damage to our understanding of politics. And the complex decision matrices that go on behind voters making their choices are things that have sort of got flattened. And actually, this is something that conversations with voters bring out very clearly, because it's actually quite inspiring to talk to voters about what animates their vote choices. And these are often very lofty ideals. They are not as literal or flattened or limited as surveys would have us believe. So I think there's a lot of triangulation of data that's not happening right now, which we need much more of, because there's so much studying of the Indian voter that's happening, but it's really very limited right now.
And a final issue that I wanted to get your thoughts on, Rukmini, which if I had one takeaway from the book, for me personally, for me it was the insights you have that, you know, we like to think of India being an open, liberal country, but the numbers put a pretty persuasive portrait of something the opposite. And the thing that really struck me was it isn't a generational thing. And that if younger people in surveys and express themselves in other ways are far less progressive than what people would imagine. So how is it that there's such a gap between, say, our own, is it delusion, our own perceptions of India being a certain way, yet having such a strong body of evidence to suggest that the actual picture is something very different?
Yeah, you know, that chapter was actually the last one I wrote, and almost as an afterthought, because I actually felt that this point had been made so frequently. But it's one of those things,
right?
You marshal all the data and put it together, you realize that it's making a point that really takes people aback. I have found that, you know, in reader responses. And I think this point about young people in particular is something that it's not just taken people aback, it's also sort of, you know, fitting into place now. When you just look at the last 2 weeks, even in India, there's such a sort of wave of religious intolerance that we're seeing day after day coming out. And the growing realization that this could not happen. We always assume that what this needs is political backing, and of course it does, but it also does need mass popular support. And I think that part of the equation is something we perhaps, you know, not come to terms with. So there's a couple of things. One is, I do think that there's a lot of talking within bubbles that happens in India, and perhaps liberals have painted these thoughts as fringe thoughts without accepting that perhaps they are the fringe, and these are very much mainstream thoughts. And I think there's been a trope around India that liberals have found comforting, which is that, you know, Indians may not rent their Hindus may not rent their house to a Muslim, or they might not allow their daughter to marry a Muslim, but they're basically decent people, and, you know, with broadly tolerant views. And, you know, you have all these Diwali ads around interreligious friendships. And unfortunately, I just don't think that that's what the center or the core of the country is like. And we're seeing this. We're seeing this in electoral outcomes. We're seeing this in surveys, and we're seeing it on the street. But this is a sort of reality we have to come to terms with, that if all evidence points in one direction, there's no point hugging this comforting lie to ourselves anymore.
And yours isn't, you do give us a realistic portrait, but you aren't fatalistic about it. And you make the argument that these aren't inevitabilities. But of course, the point that you make is, if you want to make a policy intervention, the first step is to recognize the problem first. So on a final note, Rukmini, can you tell us a little bit about how you think at the moment interventions are made, and the way you think it should go from here?
Yes, I don't feel fatalistic about it at all, because I do think that there are ways out of it. But the thing is to first come together to accept that this is a national project. If you do agree that this is a common project, to at the very least have people more tolerant and accepting of each other's beliefs, then there are pathways to it. But I don't see that common ground even yet. Enough people sort of coming out and saying that this is something that they want to pursue. And I think we've left too much of it to the domain of electoral politics alone. While if these are the views young people hold, then what's happening in schools? What's happening in colleges? What are happening in non-political social arenas as well? You know, as soon as we sort of come together to say that this is a project that we would like to pursue to have people have more tolerant beliefs, then we have to think of the sort of civic work that it will take to achieve this, and not just, you know, put it down to polarized politics alone.
Thank you so much, Rukmini, for your time. I think we've just got to the surface of the things that you cover in your book. I encourage people to read it for themselves. Rukmini, the author of Whole Numbers and Half Truths, What Data Can and Cannot Tell Us About Modern India. Thank you so much for joining the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me, Anand.
Thank you for listening to The Hindu on Books. You can now find The Hindu's podcasts such as In Focus and Parlay on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other major platforms. Write to us with comments and feedback at socmed4@thehindu.co.in.